The story of Elisha in the first reading is nice enough on its own, but it is not the full tale. What we have here selected for the liturgy is a rather abbreviated form of the whole thing. And I think it'd be good to just on your own go and read it, as it is a good story. But it's also important, I think, to know some of the larger context of it, of what's going on, because then it makes Christ's words from the gospel have a slightly different inflection than we would get just from what we have paired with it here. And there's two lines, then, two scenes perhaps from the story that kind of want to drill down a little bit more in relation with the gospel. One is the bit about receiving a child, one who is barren now being given new life. And also, there's sort of a gap. There's a bit that's omitted between the first half and the second half, even here in the session. And it's where Elisha asks the woman directly after she has built the sort of shelter for him to stay in. He goes to her directly and says, "Well, what can I do to repay you?" And she says, I am fine. I am content. I live among my kinsmen, and that is enough for me. I don't need anything else." And so it's only then, when he can't get an answer out of her, that then he goes to his servant and is like, "Well, what can we do? She doesn't want anything. What can we do?" And then he comes up with the idea for that. So for the first part, the idea of receiving a son, we have this from the reading, but it continues, and it doesn't immediately have a very happy ending. It just sounds, "Oh, that's nice now." Yet as the tale continues, the child is born, and he grows up enough to be able to, like, run around a little bit. He's not very old, but he is old enough to be able to not help necessarily with the harvest, but he goes out with the reapers into the field. And so he's there during the harvest time, so it's late summer, so it's very hot. And what happens basically sounds like heat stroke is what happens to him. And he collapses, and he is picked up by the workers, brought in to his mother, and he dies in her arms. And she tells the workers, "Don't tell my husband, keep him safe here, prepare the mule so that I can go after the prophet to go find him." So she does this, she leaves, and she goes to where he is. Elisha's servant, Gehazi, meets her first, asks her, like, what she's looking for. She says, "I need to see the prophet." He's like, "It's not like a season for a festival. There's not like any need for an offering at this time. Why are you?" And she's like, I need to see the prophet." So he goes, okay, takes her to him and sort of steps back, leaves him alone. And she just sort of collapses. She breaks down. She's sobbing at Elisha's feet. And Gehazi comes back to, like, try and remove her. Like, "Well, she's drunk, she's upset, she needs to kind of go away and compose herself." And Elisha holds him back and he says, "No, she's a mother and she's in grief." So he knows what's going on. He understands at least something is happening that needs to be addressed. And so he speaks with her, finds out what the situation is, and then gives his staff to his servant and says, "Gehazi, go back to the house before us," and basically, like, lay the staff on the child. So he does that. They, the prophet and the woman, make their way more slowly back. And they're met by Gehazi at the entrance to the house. And he says, it didn't do anything. Nothing happened. And Elisha's like, I know. Takes the staff back, goes into the house, and the child is brought back to life. And it is done in that way to emphasize that it is not just like some human power doing it. It's not like there's some spell Elisha knows, or he has like some magic talisman like his staff that is able to now go and do something miraculous. It is the power of the Lord. It is because the prophet is obedient to the word of God. Only then is God's power manifested. It is not through his own efforts, not through his own striving, that something happens, but it is because the Lord has chosen him to be an instrument. So that sort of puts things in a little different context for the gospel. Because what Christ is saying is not a natural understanding of like good social relationships. It's not like, well, pay it forward so that then you can receive something good as it kind of like circulates in some sort of like moral economy. What he is saying is that you must do good, and it must be a work of grace. It must be free. Because the good that is received is something that is miraculous. It's a work of God. It is not just something of human power. It's something supernatural. If you do good to a good person, well then, like, you can sort of naturally expect from them something good that's commensurate with what was done. But if you do good for those who don't deserve it, if you do good for the little ones who can't repay, then you don't just get like a little reward back. God acts. The power of the Lord is present in a new way for us. The Lord will do. It's not just what is received on a human level. Having a child born, even in a sort of barren situation, can be unusual, but it's not outside the normal rhythm of human experience. It's strange, but it's not wholly outlandish. It's not something other. A child coming back to life is. That is not something that normally happens. So to receive a prophetic benefit from treating a prophet well is sort of understandable. But again, to receive a reward from someone who can't even provide water for themselves is not. It is the work of God. And it's only possible because it is assured by the word of God himself. It's not just something we can hope for, something expect in a sort of abstract way. God has spoken. Because the word has spoken, therefore it must be. Then there is the second part I kind of want to go into, about the woman when Elisha asks what he can do, says that she's content to be among her own people. And it's somewhat of an ironic response, because it's like four chapters later that a famine is decreed that is to be harsher than the one that Elisha's predecessor, decreed. So there's supposed to be something worse that is coming. And so Elisha warns the woman, and she takes her child and leaves. Evidently, by this point, her husband had died, because it is just them who go to the land of the Philistines in order to save themselves. Again, another thing of ironic. Rather than just being content with her own people, she goes to the land of Israel's enemies. She goes to the main antagonists against Israel to find life. And they remain there for the duration of the famine. And eventually, after things have calmed down, she comes back. But when she comes back, she finds out that all of those kinsmen that she wanted to stay with have appropriated her land. They've taken it for themselves, for their own use, and they're not giving it back. That kind of a thing of taking someone's inheritance is forbidden under Jewish law. So she goes to the king and presents herself, sort of just says who she is, and says that she's the one who, the child who died and was raised. So that's sort of how to identify her. Elisha's servant Gehazi is called upon to basically vouch for her, and he says, yes, this is her. And the king not only restores to her her property, but also says all of the income that that property has produced over the past few years when she was absent due to the famine needs to be returned to her as well. So she doesn't just get the thing that she was asking for, but she gets more besides. And it's not done because she's an important person. She's a landless single mother at this point. She has no clout. The only thing that she has is that God did something for her. She has received something of grace. She has received freely something unasked for, unsought, that the Lord had willed to do in her midst. And because of that, then she now receives even more than what she had. So those who hear the word of the Lord and obey it, even at great hardship and sacrifice to themselves, are not just promised that they will sort of get back what they put into it. It's not just what you have given up you will receive again, but you will receive more than that. And not because you sort of earned it, not because it has like made you worthy of the gift, but because the Lord is the giver who desires to provide it. The Lord wishes to share. The woman wants to stay with her kinsman, says that she wants nothing else. And yet, at a command from the prophet, at the word of the Lord speaking in her life, she is willing to do that, to leave them, to depart, to go somewhere else. She drops everything to be obedient to the promptings of the Lord. She also doesn't cave into her own sort of like selfish need to be vindicated, to be heard, to be respected. When her child is dead, she hides it from everyone. She doesn't want her husband to know. She wants the servants to keep it quiet. She doesn't even want the servant or the prophet to know. Like the one who is basically the gatekeeper who's keeping her away from him at the moment. None of these people can help. None of these people, they matter in that way. If she announces it, she dumps all of this on them, well then that's for her benefit. It doesn't help anything. She goes to the one whom she knows can do something. She goes to the voice of the Lord. She goes to the prophet. When she comes back and finds that all her things are taken, she doesn't like stand outside and scream at all of her family. She doesn't like go through town complaining loudly about how these people took everything from her. She goes to the king. She goes to the place where she can seek restitution. She goes to where the problem can be solved. She goes knowing that she has no power. She goes in meekness and humility, and that opens her up to being able to receive what's given. So if we focus on our own power, if we try to just rely on our own efforts to sort of carve out a reward, then it will come to ruin because it's something just of our own effort, of our own energy, of this world. It will blow away. So instead, we must use that effort to allow us to be shaped more like her, to become someone who's able to receive what the Lord has intended to give. Not what I want, but what God desires for me. Because what we want can, in the end, if it's just of this world, come back to bite us. The kinsfolk the woman wanted to be with are the ones who take everything. So in the midst of our own trial, of our own troubles, whether they're very personal, whether they're just like within our family, whether they're the things of the world at the moment, it's important, I think, to look and to find out where is the Lord seeking to give us grace that we aren't looking for. What does the Lord desire to give to me that I am not paying attention to? I'm ignoring because I'm focused on this. What comforts are we being asked to leave behind so that a greater good can be made present to us? Something new and real can be in our midst. And lastly, are we seeking good from the one who can truly grant it? Are we going to the Lord for what we need? Or are we focused on sort of like flailing about? We're just going to like throw ourselves at whoever might listen, just to sort of like vent and get it out and just like announce all of these troubles, rather than gathering them together, holding them, bearing them, and allowing them to be made an offering before the Lord, to be able to be set on the altar as gift, so that then we can have hands that are now able to receive. I think those things are something for us to ponder, and hopefully then it can allow our hearts again to be crafted more in her image, so that then we can be a people who are able to receive the graces the Lord has in store for us.